My name's Candice Partridge and I'll be chairing the session on value creation through behavioural life insurance. I'd like to introduce our two presenters. Unfortunately, the co-author of the paper, Greg Morris, couldn't attend today, but we're very glad to have Stephen Cransdorf in his place. He's come in at very short notice. Stephen Cransdorf has been a fellow of the Actuarial Society of South Africa and the Faculty and Institute of Actuaries of the UK since 2008. He began his career at Discovery Life, a South Africa-based life insurer with a focus on consumer-engaged insurance products that rewards customers for improving their health. In 2008, Stephen joined Discovery's startup venture in the UK, Pruprotect, which is now Vitality Life, and he was responsible for new product development initiatives, working on product design, pricing, and market messaging. Since April 2015, Stephen has been part of the product development team at AIA Vitality, and AIA Vitality is a Hong Kong-based partnership between AIA and Discovery. AIA Vitality focuses on evolving Discovery's insurance and incentivized wellness capabilities for AIA's Asian market clients. Our other co-author and presenter is Adam Stoltz. Adam is the head of actuarial retail insurance AIA Australia. Adam has been a fellow of the Actuaries Institute Australia since 2001 and has had wide range of experience in Australia and internationally across life insurance, retirement, savings and risk management. Currently, Adam is responsible for actuarial pricing and valuation for AIA's Australian business, taking the role in 2014. From 2003 to 2014, Adam was working with the AXA Group in Paris and New York in a variety of different roles. These included group risk management, head of life product risks, specialising in variable annuity products and responsible for AXA's product approval process. US product development, led product development for structured capital strategies, first self-hedging US variable annuity and recipient of a US patent for this innovation. And Group Life Reinsurance, head of Global Life Reinsurance, reviewing AXA's life reinsurance strategy and implementing several significant transactions. Before 2003, Adam worked as an actuarial consultant with Trowbridge Deloitte, leading various financial modelling and valuation projects in Australia and Asia. So, with that, I'd like to introduce our presenters.
Thanks very much, Candice. So I'm Adam, the second of the people that were introduced. Good to see we have a full crowd. I think there's about three spare seats. And so very happy for you to be here. As Candice was saying, we're happy to take questions throughout, but given the logistics of being taped, we may have more at the end. So it's a very ambiguous title we have here, Evaluation Questions Through Behavioural Life Insurance. I tactically chose it to try and get fewer people to come, but it sounds like that you've all seen through that, so I'm happy to hear. What we're really talking here is in terms of a changing business model in life insurance and talking to how the current business model works today and how that needs to evolve and how through a Vitality program that we've had in Discovery in South Africa as well as in AI Australia, we believe that that's what's one potential new innovation as part of this new business model. So what we'll be taking through today is going through the challenges of the current traditional model and how that needs to evolve, what this new dynamic value proposition looks like, and a case study of how it has succeeded in South Africa, and then a brief discussion of how we've adapted it to Australia. So as a starting point, just to be clear in terms of understanding our environments, as you all know, the nature of risk is changing. Two areas that I wanted to highlight here is first in terms of doctors are getting very good at solving disease and making us live longer, and so more and more we're seeing that lifestyle factors and behaviour is the major cause of illness and mortality, and so a lot of our business model needs to be focusing on those aspects. And actually there's well-credentialed research by the Oxford Health Alliance which has identified there's three behaviours that cause the major contributors to four diseases, and those four diseases or conditions contribute to 50% of deaths worldwide. That's a worldwide statistic. If you look at Australia, those four conditions contribute to about 90% of deaths in Australia. So those three behaviours are smoking, poor nutrition, and physical inactivity. And so by tackling those three underlying causes, we can potentially see strong improvement in mortality and injury which is underlying 90% of deaths in the Australian market. The other big thing which we've seen change is in terms of technology, in particular around wearable devices. So Fitbits and all the other associated products around that, there's been a huge proliferation of these devices, and with that we can get some data. So the question is, how can we use this new technology and this new access to data to help reward people who exhibits good underlying behaviours that should lead to either lower premiums for life insurance or higher benefits or some combination thereof. So maybe as a question, how many of you are wearing a Fitbit or a wearable device at the moment? Okay, maybe about 10%, so I always like to have some audience participation. In terms of back to the traditional model, this is how insurance works today, is we have some underwriting at the time of policy issue, and we set that price at the start, and then over time that would generally only vary due to age and very little to do with other factors. And so you may have two, as seen by the two pictures here, two types of customer, one of which is exhibiting very healthy behaviours, other unhealthy, and in the current model we would continue to offer that need to pay the same premium for the same benefits over the life of the policy with no differentiation between the underlying behaviours. And so what of course this means is, to the extent that someone is leading healthy behaviours and so that their cost of risk is reducing, then they have a force of leaving and that they should get re-underwritten with a new policy to get the cheaper rate. And likely for the person who is having the unhealthy behaviours, they have a force to stay, because if they were to leave and be re-underwritten, then their premium may go up. And in this traditional model, we think that, though, as we're seeing in the Australian market with the level of very high lapse rates that we're seeing, that this prevalence of adverse lapse behaviour, we're starting to see signs of this. And so we need to think about how do we change our business model to get ahead of that. So this slide just covers similar things to what I've just been saying, which is that we have one mortality assumption that's varied by age and gender and maybe smoker status, but doesn't really take into account a lot of the individual behaviours that are exhibited by our customers. And we press our pricing based on rating factors at the time of issue and not updated over time. So things such as the health status or changes in smoker status are not something that are systematically collected. And we believe that as an industry, we should be taking advantage of that to better manage the risk and better price this risk. So at this stage, I'll hand over to Stephen to take the next stage.
Great, thanks Adam, and hello everyone. It's great to be here today to be able to share some details, mainly based on the discovery experience and how insights into customers' behaviour can be used to add value to insurance products. As Adam has outlined, our view is that the traditional insurance model has not kept pace with evolving risks, and in particular, the model today is static. It is unable to adapt as a customer's wellness changes over time. And if we are to develop a new insurance model, what we need to recognise is that as a person's wellness changes over time, it's important to recognise this within the insurance product. But wellness itself is an individual behaviour. People make decisions about whether to go to gym. They make decisions about whether to continue smoking. So if we are to understand wellness, we need to understand human behaviour. And one of the key insights that we'd like to bring is that human behaviour is often irrational. And we've put together three examples just to demonstrate how behaviour in certain circumstances may not be intuitive or may not be rational. The first we refer to as the healthcare wellness paradox. So when a person becomes ill, they have a choice to go see a doctor. In some cases, medicine will be prescribed or they'll have to undergo surgery or some form of treatment. But whatever the treatment is, the effects of it are likely to be immediate. So there's a short-term solution to the problem of the person's illness. And often the costs associated with this healthcare are hidden. That's because often you have Social Security where the cost of the healthcare is funded, or the person can have private medical insurance and the cost of the insurance is spread over a larger group of people. So the true impact of the illness or the health issue isn't known to the customer, but the benefit of the treatment is felt immediately. On the other side of the scale, you have wellness. So a person can take action to try and improve their health so that in the long term they don't suffer from that illness. But the cost of engaging in that wellness is upfront. If you want to engage in a sport activity, there may be an opportunity cost. You have to give up time to engage. There may be barriers to engaging in the sporting activity through the cost of sporting equipment. So engaging in wellness activity incurs a cost up front, yet the benefit of the wellness is far down the line into the future. So there's this paradox between taking action to improve your wellness, incurring the cost up front, but only seeing the benefit in the longer term, whereas if you do get the illness, you get the benefit immediately and the cost is hidden. So because of this difference in the way in which wellness and healthcare display benefits and cost, what we find is that people generally don't engage in wellness and rather wait for the healthcare industry to fix their illness problems, which, although the best behavior may be to engage in wellness activities, it's often too easy to rely on the healthcare industry to solve problems. The second example relates to a study that was done on people's perceptions about their own health. And what the study did was bring together a group of people who were suffering from chronic illnesses, and they asked people to rate their what they thought was the perception about their health. And the striking thing about the study is that despite everyone who was interviewed was ill, the majority of people actually thought that they were in good health. And even more striking about the study is that people who suffered from more than one chronic illness, so in the case there were three where they suffered from three illnesses, more people thought they were in good health than people who suffered from only one illness. So clearly as individuals, we're not very good at judging the state of our own health. So if we are unable to know whether we're healthy or not, how can we then make decisions about what wellness activities to engage in? The third example relates to how a person's time horizon can influence the decisions that they make. So many behavioral scientists would have probably performed this research in their training, and they bring together a group of people and offer them $10 today or the promise of $11 the following day. And what you'll find is that the majority of the people will rather have the money immediately. They'll take the $10 and they'll give up the extra $1 for the cost of having to wait a day. But if you give them the same option, so the $10 or the $11, but phrase it slightly differently and say you'll pay the $10 in 30 days' time or $11 in 31 days' time, most people would choose the $11 in 31 days' time. So despite the fact that in both cases there's only a delay of one day and the benefit which is being derived by the individual is the same, the choice that they make is different. So clearly, when faced with a decision, the time horizon over which the decision is made has an impact on the outcome. So the three examples which we've just been through are really related to the theory of behavioral economics. And what we've tried to do is pull out some of the principles of behavioral economics which we think are relevant to understanding people's attitudes towards wellness. The first of the principles is overconfidence and optimism. So clearly, as we saw from that study, people generally overstate the extent of their health. And because of this, it becomes difficult for them to make the decisions to engage in the wellness activities, because most of the time people probably think that they're well and that the need to engage is not there. The second of the principles relates to what is called loss aversion. And this is the principle that the utility that someone loses from taking something away from them is greater than the utility that they gain if you give them something that they didn't have before. So if you tell someone that they need to give you $100, they're likely to be a lot more upset by that than if you had to go to them and give them $100 that they didn't have in the first place. And the link between loss aversion and wellness is that wellness often requires people to lose something. They have to lose their time, they have to lose money to engage in the activities. So because of this, trying to push people towards wellness activities in itself creates some type of barrier. The third principle we refer to as frequent event miscalculation. A good example of this would be smoking. People often realize that the long-term effects of smoking are negative. People are aware of the additional morbidity risks. They understand that it leads to heightened risk of cancer. Yet they're unable to attribute that risk to themselves. And the reason they find is that because the event involves a repeated scenario, so you're smoking on a regular basis, and the impact of each cigarette is actually quite small. It's more the cumulative effect over a long period of time that leads to the risk. People are unable to quantify the smaller impacts. And so because they're unable to see the impact of each cigarette, they dismiss the ultimate outcome, which is the heightened risk of cancer and other conditions. The next principle, hyperbolic discounting, refers to the impact of a person's time horizon. So if you offered someone a reward sometime in the future, they're likely to value it far less than if you were giving them the same reward today. And that links into the idea of wellness, because the benefits from wellness are long-term and many years into the future. So trying to get people to understand that there is a reward, but that it just happens at a future time point, becomes very difficult to do. Nudge theory is the school of thought that if you want to encourage someone to do something, rather than compelling them to do it, the way to get people to change their behavior is by giving them positive reinforcement or indirect suggestions in order to get them there. So setting the default option to a desired course of action, you may be able to generate, make it easier for people to engage in that activity rather than expecting them to change the way they do things. With status quo bias, I guess we're all humans and we all like to continue doing things the way we currently do them. So changing people's current behavior becomes very difficult if you're trying to encourage them to do something different or change their daily routine. And lastly, many studies have shown that offering financial incentives are often the easiest way to change people to behave in a certain way. So linking wellness with financial reward can have a strong impact. So we think you can bring all these principles of behavioral economics together in order to create a new dynamic value proposition for life insurance. And at the heart of this new model of life insurance should be access to a health and wellness program. So in order to give people access to wellness activities, it often involves giving them discounted access to a gym, giving out free fitness devices so that everyone can experience these activities without incurring that significant cost. But we know that just making the program available probably isn't going to encourage behavior. What we need is to bring in the principles of nudge theory, introduce incentives and rewards to provide the extra motivation to get people to engage in activities. So provide the access program and then link rewards to people who engage in the program. And then lastly, the program should be fully integrated into the insurance proposition. In this way, you can link the financial rewards to the actual insurance. So people can get premium discounts on their insurance if they're healthier. People can get cashbacks, or even upfront discounts could be provided. This type of insurance model does exist. Discovery Life, which has been around for about two decades now, launched the Vitality Program. And the idea behind this program was to allow people to engage in wellness activities, improve their health. By improving their health, the claims cost for the insurance company would come down. And that saving could then be fed back to the clients in order to provide them with greater rewards and greater motivation. So the Vitality Program in South Africa is divided into three simple steps. The first step is to improve your health. So this is the part that involves access to gyms and access to fitness devices. So all of these are provided to member at substantially discounted rates. And in South Africa, there are even relationships with some of the largest grocery supermarket chains in order to provide discounts on healthy items like fruit and vegetables. As you engage in the program and you undertake these activities, you earn points. Everyone starts off on bronze status, and when they reach the next points threshold, they go on into silver, and then eventually gold and platinum status. As you go up the ladder and you earn a higher status, the rewards that you get access to get bigger and bigger. So some of the rewards, which is the second step of the program, involves free movie tickets. It could involve discounts on flights to up to 50%. The rewards themselves are set separately from the wellness activity. So the idea is to find activities that people want to engage in, something aspirational, and allow them to receive the reward immediately. And by giving people rewards, what we're doing is bringing forward the impact of the wellness. So rather than have to wait many years into the future to see that their health has improved, you're substituting it with rewards up front to give them that motivation to engage in the healthy activities. And then lastly, because we're not able to judge our own health effectively, what we need to do is play back the information about wellness back to the customer. So the third step is knowing your health. Through online websites, through mobile apps, we feed all the information back to the client so they're able to track their daily activities, understand their status, and see the impact that is being made. And the program itself is fully integrated into the insurance proposition. So a traditional insurance company may price off a mortality curve, which is the gray line, a traditional curve. But because Discovery offers the wellness program, they see two effects. The first is that they're attracting healthier lives to the insurance company generally. So because of this, there's a massive selection impact in terms of the lives that are buying the insurance. And the second impact is that those people who do come in and may not have been healthy or had healthy behaviors are now encouraged and motivated to change their behavior to become healthy. And because of this, Discovery finds itself in the great position where the mortality and morbidity experience that they experience is far below what the rest of the market is seeing. And so because of this, we have a dynamic underwriting curve which is able to reflect a lower mortality rate. And the benefit of this is given back to the customer through upfront discounts. So where the market would be somewhere between those brown lines, Discovery's average price starts much lower than the market rate. But the great thing about the program is that it's ongoing and we can track people's behavior over a long period of time. So for those customers who most engage in the program and whose risk is coming down, we can give further premium decreases. For customers who aren't engaging in the program and aren't engaging to the same extent as what we'd anticipated up front, their premiums can increase. But because of the selection effect, even those customers who aren't engaged in the program can land up paying a much lower premium than an ordinary policyholder would have to pay through another insurance company. So if we take a case study of a particular policyholder from Discovery, the blue line represents the premium, the cumulative premium they pay over time for someone who isn't engaged in the program, and the other lines show the premiums that we paid for various vitality statuses. And even the lowest status, which is bronze, we find that the customer is paying a lower premium over the term of the policy up to about 16, 17 years' time. So significant savings for everyone involved, not only the healthiest and the fittest amongst us. I guess the question everyone has is, so does the program work? And the good news is that the experience seems to suggest, yes, it does. Discovery is now a global company. They've got millions of customers based in the UK and based in South Africa. They have a venture in America as well as a venture with AIA around Australia and Asia. And the experience from all these markets is that the program does encourage healthy activity and that healthy activity does lead to lower mortality and morbidity rates. So the impact is significant for both mortality and morbidity, although more so for mortality. The more engaged a person is, the lower the mortality and the morbidity rate. And the benefits don't only link to mortality and morbidity, they also manifest themselves in terms of persistency. So customers who engage in the program clearly are enjoying the benefits, enjoying the rewards, and through this, they're more likely to maintain their policies. So what we find is that the more highly engaged members are very, very unlikely to lapse their policies. So through better persistency, through better mortality, through better morbidity, we're creating additional value. And the great thing about this value is that it can be passed back to the customer. So the more value that's created, the deeper the discounts that can be given to those who are engaged, the more rewards, the more financial incentives we can give. And for financial advisors, there are also benefits. The better persistency should mean more stable revenue streams for them. It creates a new target market to speak to. The Vitality Program changes the perception of insurance. Insurance is no longer about a contract which you lock away in your drawer and never look at again. It's something that the customer is engaging with on a day-to-day basis. They're associating their wellness activities with the insurance product. And because of this, it makes the sale of insurance much easier and leads to better persistency all around. And then lastly, the value that's created is not only for the insurance company, the customer, and the broker. If we think more holistically at society as a whole, we think that by promoting wellness, by promoting these activities, the benefit shouldn't be confined to just the customers. Customers will speak to their family, they'll speak to their friends, and hopefully by engaging in these activities and having discussions around it, the message will be broadened and society as a whole should be able to benefit through the program. I'm now going to hand back to Adam, who's going to speak about the applications in the Australian market.
Many thanks, Stephen. So Stephen's taking you through the journey that Discovery and South Africa have taken. So in Australia, we launched a similar program last year. But before we launched it, we needed to do some in-depth research to assess whether these principles held. And so we did it Australian style. So I'll just play a video. Hopefully it works.
Hot donuts! Yeah! bag of donuts, good for $2. 4 bags of donuts, please.
Can I get 4 donuts?
4 donuts. And before I grab you the donuts, I'll just let you know we're also selling fruit salads today for $4.
Oh no, I'm going to go for the very unhealthy.
Yeah, do you like to switch?
No, I'll have a donut, thank you.
Sure.
I've had my fruit salad this morning already.
There you go.
Yeah. Alright. No, thanks.
Would you like to switch?
Okay.
We have these fruit salads here.
Yep.
From $4 to $1. I guess it's a lot healthier than a donut. Would you like to make the switch to the fruit salad? It's quite scrumptious, though.
Sure, why not?
Awesome.
I'll come in back. So I'll get a fruit salad later today.
Later. Donuts are hard to resist.
I think so.
Yeah?
You get these delicious fruit salads for only $4, and if you switch to the fruit salad, you get one of these $10 Maya gift vouchers.
Yeah, sold.
Sold?
Yeah.
Would you like to switch?
Yeah.
Okay, excellent.
Coming for a donut. Oh, I'm going to have my donut fixed, sorry.
Would you like to switch over?
Yeah.
Excellent. Would you like to make the switch over?
Yeah.
If you switch to the fruit salad, you get one of these discounted moving vouchers.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
All right, just give me the fruit salad and give me the... That would be a dream deal.
Yep.
Oh, you guys are crazy.
We are pretty crazy, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yep, switch from the donut. Excellent.
So that was the extent of the research we did, and but it was pretty conclusive, so we decided to stop there. So we've been talking a lot in terms of theory and concepts of what are we talking about when we're talking about incentives. And so in Australia, we had to make some decisions of how we're going to integrate the software with our product. And we need at least one slide with lots of numbers on it. So this is it. And so we... First, we're looking at a lump sum product that's covering for death and trauma and total and permanent disability benefits. We give an upfront initial discount currently of 7.5% of the premium if you sign up for this program. And then there's an annual premium flex. What this means is how does that discount change over time? So what this indicates that if you stay at the bronze status is that the discount is going to go away at the rate of 1.5% per year. So if you do the math, after 5 years, you'll be back to where you started. Having said that, you would have benefited from 5 years of lower premiums than you would have otherwise. Another extreme, if you engage fully in the program and achieve platinum status, then you can continue to get an extra 1% discount per year. And that brings us to the premium lower bound so that you can have a maximum 20% discount if you on platinum, if you do the math for 12 or 13 years. And then on top of that, currently we have a cash back every fifth year. And so even at bronze level, that's 2% of your cumulative premiums. So after 5 years, paying 5 years of premiums, you get 2% of each of those, or 10% of 1 year's premium for a level premium product. Cash back goes up, so if you're platinum status, you get a 10% cash back every fifth year, which is quite substantial. We then, for our income protection product, calibrated it quite differently and gave no upfront discounts given the pricing margin we have on that product, but do promote having an annual premium flex that you do get discounts over time. So the prices will go down over time if you engage in the program and you can get a material discount, but there's no cash back. Having said that, most of our customers who are taking out income protection will take out lump sum with us, and so we can look at it from a customer perspective. They're probably getting the combined impact of those two when they engage in the program and if they're buying a full insurance offering. So this is what we currently have today. But as I said, we launched last year, so we may continue to review and enhance that depending on the feedback we get from customers. So, as I said, it was launched in March of last year in Australia. We've had a take-up rate of about 30% so far, which we're very happy with. Of course, we want that to increase over time, but after 1 year, we compared to what has been seen in other markets, that's quite good. And so one of the actual questions here is obviously the nice graphs that you saw from Stephen is how do we translate that to an Australian experience, and do we expect it to be the same? In short, we don't expect it to be the same exactly, but we think that if the right investment and designed and communicated in the right way, we think we can get a substantial proportion of that benefit. But of course, there's big differences between Australia and South Africa in terms of socioeconomic status, in terms of the nature of the product design in our industry, as well as the level of engagement in vitality, which may come down to the design of the program and how it's works in the market. So, for example, in Australia, we have very big importance in terms of the impact of rating houses in terms of selling life insurance in Australia. So that's an extra factor that we don't see, or less see, in South Africa, for example. Having said that, we did take into account partially the South African experience, but of course the proof is in the pudding. We need to review this over time in Australia, so we need to get started. We need to start building that experience and then adapt over time. And so that's what we're hoping to do. So with that, that's the end of our presentation. Hopefully found that interesting. So we're going to hand over to questions. So who wants to be first cab off the rank? Yes, if you go to the microphone, thank you.
And please identify yourself. Thanks.
Hello, I'm Stephen Lee from Fitbit Consulting. How does the Fitbit feature into your premiums? Is it just is there live feedback into the premiums?
Good question. So the premiums are fed back in terms of the class of engagement you have, so bronze, silver, gold and platinum. And so the Fitbit is one of the main areas you can earn points to go above the different statuses. So the way it's calibrated at the moment is very simply, if you do 10,000 steps in one day on a Fitbit or related device, you would get 50 points. And if you do 12,500 or more in a day, then you'll get 100 points. And to achieve, to go from bronze to silver, you need a total of 10,000 points. And then each status is an extra 10,000 points. So if you do over 12,500 steps per day on a Fitbit, 100 points, so after 100 days, then you'd have enough points to go to the next status. And that's before counting other points you would get from other behaviours. So you would get points for gym visits, you would get points in terms of healthy food-related activities. You would also get points for knowing your health, just the fact of getting a health checkup or having some other health studies done we think is valuable, as Stephen said, in terms of most people don't know their health or they're overconfident, and so we also give points for that. So, I mean, with all of this thing, we're very conscious. These are not, I would say, perfect data, but we think that it is valuable, and we think overall it's a good indicator of health, although it's not a perfect indicator of health. So, of course, you know, people may game that. I know when people first get Fitbits, they work out, how can I put it on my dog or some other device to get the number of steps up? There's always going to be a bit of that. But we think over the long run, people get bored of that, and the people that are truly engaged would stick to it. Any other questions? Yes?
Thanks, it's really interesting. Question, do you have TPD and trauma added to your... are they part of the suite of products that are offered?
Correct, yes. So when before the slide on lump sum, that included TPD and trauma, and so the same upfront discount and all the features apply to those as they do to our life cover business. Yeah.
Sorry, I should have introduced. I'm Anthony Asher. The other question is to what extent do you think the incentives important, or just the culture that you're creating? I mean, if we look at the impact of the change of smoking over the last 30, 40 years, it's been that people haven't had incentives to reduce smoking, but they have. So there's been a change in culture in a way. Now, it seems to me that a lot of what you're measuring may well just be cultural rather than... I mean, it's not the incentives that are creating it. This, you're collecting a you're collecting a group of people that want to be remain fit. So there's a sort of selection, ongoing selection effect, it seems to me, in the and it's a cultural one.
Yeah, I agree. That's an excellent point. Maybe for the not hogging the microphone, I'll hand over to Stephen to maybe answer that question. We'll see if it works this time. Maybe, Stephen, if you come up.
There we go. Thanks for the question, Anthony. So I mean, I agree with you completely. I think there are two effects here that we've seen in all of Discovery's programs across the world. So clearly there is that selection impact where people who are more predisposed to engaging in healthy activities will be likely to choose a Vitality product. And where there is an advisor, often the first question there'll be is, do you go to the gym currently? Or do you engage in activity?
Hi, Sylvia Plescott. The product is quite complicated to explain with all the discounts, and my question is, how have you engaged with the advice, with your advice network, and what kind of barriers to, you know, with your through your advice channel that you see in them being wanting to understand it and sell the product?
It's a very good question, also very challenging for actuaries to answer something like sales. But you're absolutely right, it is an extra complexity, if I can call it that, to the sales process, and so we need to find the right balance when we're designing this. Is to have the right balance to keep it simple enough, but not too simple. And so when we've devised the product and also the messaging in Australia, advisors were a key part of that process. And so that's obviously something that's constantly evolving. But as well as just the design, a key part of that is the ongoing tools giving to advisors. So I think with this type of feature, there's a lot of digitally enabled tools that can be developed and used, and this can either be used by the advisors, or the advisors can basically say, go to this website or go to this app, and they can get much greater engagement from their customer base with those tools than they would have otherwise. Having said that, as you can see, the take-up rate is 30% so far. It's not 100%. So by that statistic, there is still, you know, a decent chunk of advisors who are not putting that as part of their sales story. But I think with this thing, it comes over time. If you have that 30% shows success, then another group of advisors may then look and take it on as from a second generational perspective. But it does something that requires investment and time to work through. But so far, so good. Yep.
James Hickey from Deloitte. Thanks, guys. I think one of the hardest things with life insurance in itself is just keeping people engaged. If you think about even general insurance struggles with it, you pay an annual premium, and the customer experience, you know, touch wood, you don't actually experience the benefits of that insurance till 12 months later when you pay your next premium. So there's no sort of way to touch the consumer throughout the normal annual policy cycle. I like this approach because it starts to engage with the consumer. It makes them appreciate the potential value that insurance can offer over that period. I think we're seeing with general insurance companies with telematics, they're pioneering the fact that you know, they can have that black box in your car and that monitors it. It's a bit of gamification. Consumers like that, and they like being able to get a better price for better actions, which I think is a great thing for life insurance to bring that in. I just wonder, though, whether when you showed that table of numbers, Adam, and obviously actuaries, we love that, is it too little? I mean, is it really too small to motivate, especially when you said, you know, X many 10,000 steps, do it over 100 days? It just sounds hard compared to be honest, if you get a telematics box, you can reduce your braking pressure you put in your car and you can do more real-time things. It sends a lot of effort for maybe 1% incremental benefit in a life insurance premium, which, you know, for many people is hard to be engaged with in any case.
Yeah, excellent points. I mean, obviously with the first one, we're obviously fully bought into that in terms of increasing customer engagement. In terms of the effort, I think it's a tough one because in terms of having material improvement in your wellness requires effort. And so in terms of how we calibrated that, that's obviously a big question we have. We could make it easier to get points and then people go up the statuses, but then we're not going to get the real benefits in terms of the experience then actually fund the discounts. Otherwise, it's just sort of a bolt-on wellness program that's sort of self-funding and it's not really impacting the underlying behaviour. But you're right, it is a tough one, but we So I suppose to a certain extent we're looking to get at least all the healthy people come to AIA and they can get cheaper premiums. So that's, I suppose, the immediate one. In terms of actually people coming and changing their behaviour in the long term, as Stephen was saying, the studies, is there is a material proportion of people that do that, but of course it's not for everyone. We have to calibrate to get the right the rewards for that, so we'll have to wait and see. But you're right, that is the challenge, to have that real change in behaviour. Yes, we have one already waiting in line.
Thanks, Adam. Tim Harble. Two questions then, if I'm allowed to. So, the 70% who aren't taking it up, it seems like they've got nothing to lose by taking it up. Is there any sort of behavioural observations around people not taking it up and why? And the second question is, can substandard lives take it up as well?
You're really peeling back the onion here, trying to really get inside what's going on. So I can let you know that there is one major reason why the 70% are not signing up, as I didn't mention, that it does cost, there is a cost for the program. It's $10 per month, and so people feel that the $10 per month is not worth it, even though they get discounts. Some take a very mathematical approach to that and say, oh, if I do the discount, my size of my premium. Others take a less mechanical approach. So, but that's the one obstacle. I agree, if it was free, then absolutely we should be at 100%, but there is a cost. In terms of substandard lives, yes, we do offer it to it. And so I think this goes back to, we don't want just to reward people that exhibit good behaviours that are already healthy. We do want to encourage people that maybe the health levels aren't where they'd like to be. And even if we give them, you know, a substandard loading, then they can get a discount from that, but obviously their starting point is higher. Yes?
Wayne Canifax, Landers, Australia. Look, it seems, picking up on James's question, you're always going to hit some customers. Personally speaking, as a Strava addict, the gaming element of it sounds quite appealing. So I like, you know, I was sitting there on my phone going, oh, well, I haven't got a Fitbit. Can I do this for cycling? Yes, I can do this for cycling. If I use my Garmin, okay, cool. So I think you'll get... There'll be a 5%. There'll be a corner of customers that it's worthwhile doing this if you get a corner of very loyal and very healthy customers. I guess your challenge, as James has rightly picked up on, and it's more of an observation than a question, is how do you make it about more than 5% of your policyholders? How does it become transformational?
Yeah, and I suppose that in the case study for that is Discovery. So maybe if you want to talk the journey that's taken to South Africa.
So, I mean, I think the points are valid, but the experience that we've seen in other markets is that this program really is mainstream. I mean, we're not talking about launching something for a niche market of core healthy people. And I think the key to the success here is really how we structure the reward. So the insurance benefits being the small premium changes, only one element of it. The wider element is the Vitality program itself and the rewards we offer. So what we've done is we've used the learnings from Discovery to try to understand what motivates people's behavior. So the program offers things like substantial discounts on cinema tickets through Hoyts. There are also discounts on Qantas flights and other benefits which aren't related to wellness. So those activities are mainstream. There's nothing about engaging in health that requires someone to take a flight or to go see a movie. So the key to the program is understanding that you need to provide rewards outside of the wellness to bring mainstream people into the program, and then slowly, through those rewards, provide the incentive and the motivation to get them to engage in healthy activities. So if a person comes in and doesn't cycle, doesn't run, you know, we're not going to be disappointed about it. The intention is let them come in, let them experience the rewards, and let them see that by moving up the statuses, they can enjoy even bigger and more substantial discounts. And hopefully through that, we can start to encourage them to engage in those activities. And that certainly has been the experience in both South Africa and the UK, and we're hopeful that we will see the same experience in Australia.
Yeah, maybe you want to talk about in terms of the market share growth that Discovery and Pru has seen in the UK?
Yeah, I mean, so when I joined the team in London, we launched and we had 0% market share, and when I left, we were now the third largest insurer in the protection space, and we had about 12-13% market share. And in a market that's dominated by Legal & General and Aviva, who have over 50% market share, to be the third largest player was a significant achievement. In South Africa, Discovery are by far the largest insurance company operating in the space, and have, I think, 30 or 40% market share. So clearly it's just not about being a niche player. It is very much a product that could be suitable to everyone. And the other thing to point out is the slide we showed earlier about the value for all customers. Even the unengaged customers are achieving some value, because the value that's created through the healthiest customers is shared across all the different statuses. So even someone who's unengaged and on the bronze status is still going to pay a low premium over a long period of time compared to someone who took out a product with another company.
We are being kicked out. So I'd like to thank you all for attending today's presentation. Adam and Stephen have done a wonderful job, and I think presented some really fascinating ideas on a model that's win-win for both the insurer and the end customer. And a final reminder, please fill out your short presenter feedback form on Summit Connect. Let's thank Adam and Stephen. Thank you.